Mrajuhtuden.
Mrajuhtuden.
Welcome to the Anonymous Eskimo Project, a program where I have candid conversations with guests about difficult but important Indigenous topics such as mental health, sobriety, recovery, and missing and murdered Indigenous people. These difficult topics need to be brought to the light, not only to educate, but to uplift our Indigenous relatives. Oyana, for joining me, I'm your host, Ralph Sara. On today's show, I have Yari Walker. Yari is Yupik from the village of Savunga, Alaska, on St. Lawrence Island. Yari just published her new book entitled Atak Ayuman Angwarnaki, Keep Paddling Against the Wind. Yari has 12 years of sobriety, and on today's show, Yari courageously shares her story, discusses her new book, and discusses her experience acting in HBO's hit show, True Detective Night Country. So guys, please help me welcome Yari Walker. Hi, Yari. How are you?
Hey, Ralph. I'm doing great. It's such a beautiful Sunday.
Yeah. Well, welcome back to the show. I wanted to have you back because you have something very exciting happening now. But before we get into that, can you please go ahead and introduce yourself so people listening who haven't listened to your first show can get to know you now?
Sure. My name is Yari, and I'm originally from St. Lawrence Island from Savunga, and my father's clan, the clan is Aymaramka, and my sub-clan is Sanagabalngok, and my mother's clan is Kiwarmi.
Very cool. Okay. Let's get to the good stuff here. So I wanted to have you back on because you just released your new book.
I did.
Awesome. Can you please share what your book is about?
Well, it's several things. My book is about, it's a memoir. It's about my personal experience with child abuse, sexual abuse, domestic violence, moving to Anchorage to get away, and using substances to cover my pain, eventually ending up homeless, being charged with two separate DUIs, serving time at Highland, and my healing journey. But it's also about my spiritual experiences, because I want people to know that, you know, what you experience is normal and that you're not alone. And but it's also about cultural sensitivity and inter-ethnic communication, because I want people to know that we have cultural differences and people just need to be aware of the differences in communications. And I added that in my book because as a depressed teenager and later on in life as an adult, I actually became suicidal. And when my father reached out for help, we clashed because of our cultural differences. So I included that in my book.
Very, very important. All of that. What is your book called? What's the title?
Well, my grandfather, when I was growing up, always used to tell me, Atak Ayumun Angwaranaki. He started saying to me in my late teens, which means keep paddling against the wind. So what he was referring to, that no matter what obstacles I run into life, I can get past them through work. So because of my memoir, is that. That's the title I gave it.
That is so, so awesome. I love how you incorporated that into your memoir. And you do incorporate a lot of teachings, too, that you have acquired throughout your life, huh?
I sure did, because it's so important. People need to be aware and be educated.
Yeah, the teachings are definitely need to be passed down, and I'm so, so happy that you wrote this book. Before we get into kind of your story, are you able to kind of let people know, people that haven't listened to your first one? I know we went over this in the first one, but there's people that are going to be listening that are new to this show. Mm-hmm. Can you go ahead and kind of give your backstory of how you grew up and up to the point of writing your memoir?
Sure. So my story starts as a child. We were in a house, you know, my mother, my father, my siblings, and my paternal grandparents, whom I was also raised by. But I learned a lot of Yupik ways from my paternal grandparents. They were very traditional elders. And from day one, they've always instilled our Yupik ways, our stories, and our traditions. And repetitively, my grandmother taught me the same things over and over. And I remember as a teenager, I used to have a negative attitude, not say it out loud to my grandmother, but in my mind, I would say, why are you telling me this? I already heard this before. But now that I'm a grown adult, I am so grateful that my grandmother repetitively taught our Yupik ways. She instilled those in me. Today I tell people that she spoke to my blood and my bones, so I don't forget who I am and where I come from. And when we moved into a new house, my parents, myself, and my siblings, I saw a whole different side of my mother that I've never seen before. And it all started at the age of 12. My mother was abusive to myself and my siblings, but for some reason, she especially targeted my middle sister. And I oftentimes used to wonder, you know, who is this woman? Why is she doing this? And growing up, I watched her show a lot of love and compassion towards her nieces and nephews. So I used to get jealous of my cousins because we did not get the same treatment from our mother. And, you know, I never really heard her say, I love you to us. And she was emotionally, mentally, physically abusive to us. And then I experienced sexual abuse by a relative, a family relative, and also by a family friend. And at that time, it all happened at the age of 12. All of these things started at the age of 12. And I chose at that time, I didn't know it was okay for me to talk about it. I didn't know it was okay for me to tell someone, but not because I was ashamed of what the two men did to me, but because I didn't know it was okay to talk about. I didn't know who to go to. I was also worried that my parents wouldn't believe me. So I actually kept it a secret for many, many years. And all at the age of 12, I started huffing gasoline, smoking cigarettes, smoking marijuana, and doing asphyxiation, and it had a lot to do with what happened to me with all the abuse from my mom and by the two men. So I used these as a coping mechanism. You know, I would smile, I would laugh, but deep down inside, I was very, very hurt. And I, you know, didn't want to tell my parents what happened. It happened at fish camp. But it also happened right in the village, behind the school. And then at the age of 16, when I became pregnant with my first child, I became suicidal. I attempted suicide because I was worried that my parents would disown me. And, you know, right in the middle of action, my father walked in on me and he held me and I cried. I cried from way deep inside. I was really ashamed of being young and pregnant and worried about my parents disowning me. And my father reached out to Noam Behavior Health for help for me. And when this woman came to my village once a week, it was a huge turn off for me because she came in a business suit, had a name tag, told me who she was, what her job title was, and who she worked for. And she sent me a message saying that I'm only here to do my job. And it really turned me off. And when she told me she was going to do an assessment on me, she said, you know, answer the questions as best as you can. By that time, I said, why should I speak to you? Why should I answer your questions? You don't care about me. And when the assessment began, all I could do was stare at the floor and shrug my shoulders. And at that time, I didn't really understand why I was doing it, but I was doing it. It wasn't until later on in life as an adult, I realized I was actually, without realizing it unintentionally, I was sending her messages. And the message that I was sending her by using my shoulders and staring at the floor was, why should I tell you anything about myself? You don't care about me. You're only here to do your job. I don't answer your questions. I don't want to speak to you. There's lots of things that I was telling her without realizing that. And then by the time I was 18, I started dating this young man that my senior year in high school. I get pregnant with our son and I graduated. You know, I was very pregnant. I was 8 months pregnant. I graduated from high school and we became traditionally engaged and married at a very young age. And when I was 19, when my son was 6 months old, nobody was home except for us. Because in my culture, you practice traditional St. Lawrence Island engagement way of life, which meant that he moves into my parents' house. And it's kind of like a servitude for anywhere from a year to 3 years. But he was doing that. We call that process Ningawika. And that's why he moved into my parents' house, so he can help around the house and provide for my clan people. And my son was sleeping in the bedroom. And I don't remember what caused us to have a disagreement, but I remember trying to get away from him. I tried to run from him down the hallway, but he grabbed me by the hair and he dragged me out to the living room and he began to kick me all over my body, except for my face, and especially in my private area. And somehow I managed to get away from him and I went to the bathroom and locked myself in and he banged. Eventually he gave up and he left. And I was in a lot of pain. I went to my bedroom. The whole time it happened, I was mostly concerned about my son. So I go in my bedroom. My son is still sleeping. I picked him up and put him on my lap. And I looked at his face while I was crying. And I had questions that flooded through my mind. And one of the things I asked myself was, is this what love is supposed to be? Is this normal? Is it normal for a man to beat on a woman? Because I've never seen that in my family before. I never knew nothing about domestic violence. And I didn't tell anybody because I was too ashamed. And, you know, because he kicked me so much in my private area, I had a big bruise that went all the way up to my belly button. And I had a hard time pulling my pants up using the bathroom. It was very painful. And I didn't tell anybody, you know. I was too ashamed. And it was my way of protecting him. And he came back 2 days later and asked me to take him back. He begged me to take him back. And he told me he didn't know what came over him. And he said, I don't know why I did that. And he said, I promise I'll never do it again. So I took him back. I believed him. But then I realized it was a cycle. We would go through a honeymoon stage, and then no name calling would begin, and threats, and being very insecure. I wasn't allowed to talk to other guys or say hi to them or look them in the eyes without being accused of cheating on him. And then the abuse would begin, and then the cycle would repeat itself over and over and over. Eventually, he started to bruise me on my face. And I made excuses for him. And because I played basketball anywhere from 5 to 7 days a week, when people asked me what happened to me, you know, how I ended up with a bruise on my face, I always said basketball. I got elbowed while I was playing basketball. And we moved into a one-bedroom house. By that time, we had 3 kids together. It was a small house. And I went to my mom and dad's house. My mom and dad were home alone, and just the 3 of us sitting. And I had a black eye, and my father asked me what happened. And I said it in one word without looking at my parents. I said, basketball. And my father asked, are you sure you get your bruises from basketball? I didn't know what to say. You know, I just sat there and I cried. I tried to cry so softly. I didn't want my parents to see my tears. And I went home. I didn't tell them. My father told my grandfather what happened. And my grandfather called me to his house. And he told me that my dad told him what's been happening. And he told me to tell my husband, when you go home, I want you to tell him that I want to speak to him. And then when I went home, I told him that my grandfather wants to speak to you. And of course, I get blamed and beat for that. And eventually, he gave me a broken nose. Later on, he gave me 2 broken ribs. And he would tear my clothes, break my personal belongings, especially gifts from my parents and my grandparents. And he threatened to burn me alive. And his father and another man got involved and tried to speak to him about how domestic violence wasn't right. But he wouldn't let them in. And he told them, if you don't leave, I will burn her alive. But eventually he let them in and they spoke to him, and I didn't say anything. I didn't know what to say or how to react to that. I just sat there in silence crying. But I became very scared of him. I constantly felt like I was walking on eggshells. I felt like I needed to be careful of what I say, what I do, where I go, who I spoke to, and every time he beat me, it was always my fault. And he made me believe these things. He made me believe I was at fault. And all that name calling, he made me believe I was all these things. He made me believe that no one would ever love me. I believed everything. I believed everything he said. And then I attempted suicide at the age of 29. I knew he had a rifle in the shed. And I knew it was loaded, so I go in the shed, I got on my knees, I picked up the rifle, took it off safety, and I was getting ready to shoot myself in my throat area, and he came up behind me and grabbed the rifle from me. But by that time, I wasn't afraid of him anymore, because I just wanted him to end my life. I was tired of getting beat all the time and being called names. I wasn't afraid of him anymore. I actually started to fight back. When he punched me, I punched him back, thinking if I punch him, it'll make him mad enough that he will kill me. But he didn't do it. When he kicked me, I kicked him back. When he called me names, I called him names. I was not afraid anymore. I was so depressed. I couldn't even cry anymore. I just wanted him to hurry up and end my life. But then one day I had a dream. I was in a room. There was no walls, no doors, no furniture, no decorations. The ceiling, the walls, the floor, everything was white marble. And I was laying in my fetal on the left side in a fetal position. I was paralyzed emotionally and physically. I had no emotions. I had no physical sensations. And I heard a woman humming from a far distance. I couldn't see her. But when I was finally able to see her, she appeared to be about 7 feet tall. She was floating in the air. She was about a foot off the ground, barefoot, baby blue gown. Her halo was white daisies, long brunette hair almost all the way to her ankles, blue eyes I've never seen in human to this day. And in my dream, she gently wrapped her hands around my wrists and she picked me up. But I went limp because I was paralyzed, and she wrapped her arms around my waist and she held me up. She sang to me and she danced with me. The more she did that, my physical sensations came back, my emotions came back. I was dancing with her and I was crying happy tears. I cried for the first time in many, many months. And when I woke up from that dream, I said out loud to myself, I want to live. I want to live. I want to live. I finally decided it was time for me to leave. You know, over the years, since the beatings began, I tried to create all these scenarios on how I was going to leave him. But I would try to leave, but I would always end up going back to him because he promised me he'll never do it again. And he would tell me he's a changed man. And I would believe him over and over and over and over again. But it didn't change. The only thing that changed was that the beatings became worse. They got so bad. One night he had a loaded rifle. He was intoxicated and he pointed the rifle in my face. And my kids were sleeping on the bed. I was next to them. I was begging him not to shoot me. And he held the rifle in my face for about 20 minutes. It seemed the longest 20 minutes of my life. And he put the rifle down when I said, who's going to take care of the kids? That's when he put the rifle down. And I left. I came down to Anchorage for AFN, and without even planning it, I decided to stay. That was it. I was done. And when I stayed here, the first thing, you know, when I decided I was going to stay here, the first thing I asked myself was, do I seek counseling, or am I going to run into another non-Native person who's not going to understand me or my culture? And I chose not to get help because I was worried about, you know, a non-Native counselor not understanding me or my culture. So I chose not to get help. And that's when I started to turn for alcohol as a coping mechanism to cover my pain. My drinking started to increase. You know, I went from a weekend drinker to every other day to every day. And when I was here, the first 6 months I was here, nobody hired me. I never understood why. And I remember sitting at the end of the bed and asking myself, why is nobody hiring me? Is it the color of my skin? Am I doing something wrong? And I was forced to move back to my village because now I can't support myself. Before I went home, I called my mom and dad and said, pick me up from the airport. I'm not going back to him. So they picked me up. When the plane landed, my husband at the time was right by the door, right by the airplane door, waiting for me to get out. My parents are, you know, about 50 feet away from me, and my heart was beating so hard. And I walked past them. I went straight to my parents. I didn't even look them in the eyes. I looked at my parents and said, take me to your house. So we grabbed my suitcase. We went to my mom and dad's house. My children came over. And I remember I was so happy to have my kids. It was so emotional, the reunion with my kids. And my daughter, my youngest one, was not even 2 years old. She didn't even recognize me. And that broke my heart. She was sitting in my lap and she kept staring at my face. And it broke my heart that my own daughter didn't recognize me. And while she was staring at my face, she suddenly recognized me. And, "Mom," and she hugged me so hard, and she wouldn't let go of me. And that was, I don't even know how to describe that, but it was such a huge relief. Mm-hmm. And he walked in, and he asked to speak to me in private. And I was really scared. I was really scared of him. So I go outside to speak to him, and he begged me to go back, and he said, "I'm a changed man." And he begged me to go back to him, and I said, "Yes, I'll come back to you as long as you don't ever beat me again. You have to promise me." And he said, "I promise." I go back to him at that moment. We're hugging, we're crying, we kissed, but something in my head said, "No." I stopped hugging him and looked him in the eyes, and I pointed out the door and I said, "No, leave. I'm not going back to you." And my heart was beating so hard, my legs were shaking, and he left. And when he left, I fell on my knees and I cried so hard. At that moment, I said, "I got my power back. I got my power back." And so I came back maybe another six months later. The second time I came back, and this is a true story, I said to myself, "I got to watch white people. I want to know what I did wrong the first time. I want to learn how to fit in." So I decided to sit in random public places to study white people. The first place I go to, Diamond Center, I sit there waiting for white people to come my way. Around the corner comes this woman in high heels, wearing a dress, her nails done, hair put up. And the first thing I asked myself was, "Am I supposed to dress like her?" And that made my heart beat so hard because I was raised in jeans and t-shirts. And they, you know, and mm-hmm. we're taught to be our authentic selves, to be genuine, to be real.
Man, totally amazing. Where can people find your book?
I'm going to tell you. Right now it's available on Amazon. On paperback and also ebook.
So exciting. Well, Yari, I really want to thank you so much. I wanted to have you on to promote your book and tell your story. And oh my gosh, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me again, Ralph. I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for helping me promote the book.
Well, that's all for today's show. I hope you, the listeners, found some inspiration, strength, and hope. Listen next week when I have another strong, courageous person on who is walking with us on this healing journey. This program is available as a podcast. You can hear this and many more episodes wherever you listen to podcasts or at anonymouseskimo.com. Join in the Anonymous Eskimo Project on KBOO Community Radio, translating on 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, 104.3 FM in Corvallis, Oregon, and 91.9 FM in Hood River, Oregon. I'm your host, Ralph Sara. Biura!
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.